Welcome to TechNet Radio, your guide to the IT universe.
Hi, and welcome back to TechNet Radio. I'm your host, Aurora Queen. Today we close out our November Vista theme to talk about how Microsoft IT optimizes client security by using Windows Vista. Michael Murphy interviews Andre Howard and Ben Shai, who have both been focused on client security and driving the technology adoption of emerging security features in Windows Vista. After the interview, I'll close it out with some information on events and webcasts. Here's Michael Murphy, Andre Howard, and Ben Shai on TechNet Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another installment of How Microsoft Does IT. My name is Michael Murphy. It's a pleasure to be back with all of you. And today, I am really psyched because we have with us Andre Howard and Ben Shai. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Great. Thank you, Michael.
Very good. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you both here. For our audience, let me just introduce you. Andre joined Microsoft United Kingdom. You'll know which one he is, I assure you. In April 1999 as a senior operations analyst. 4 years later, he transferred to Redmond, Washington as a technologist on charge management practices and for what was once known as the Global Client Software Group. Ben has worked at Microsoft since 2000 in a variety of roles in IT, including technologists with the Global Client Software Group deploying Windows 2000 and Telemira technologies, and program manager in the rollout of patch management in the RAS space. So what's really exciting about the conversation here is that these are the gentlemen that have been focused on client security and driving the technology adoption of emerging security features in Windows Vista. And of course, as everybody knows, we recently released to manufacturing Windows Vista, and so it's on its way. And the claim from Microsoft is that this is the most secure out-of-the-box operating system to ever come out of R&D in Redmond. And gentlemen, the reason why you're here today is to explain to us why it is the most secure client operating system to come out of Redmond and what we've done internally with some of this stuff to secure our internal environment. So, Andre, why don't you lead us off and talk a little bit about what processes you've been engaged in during this rollout.
Thanks, Michael. So as a technologist in the Microsoft IT group, my focus was around how we optimize security with a brand new operating system such as Windows Vista. In the past with Windows XP, NT, 4, 3, Windows 2000 Server, Windows 2003, pretty much, you know, most people in our environment especially are admins of their machines. And one of the features that we wanted to see out of Windows Vista was the user account control where, in essence, basically everybody becomes a standard user. No longer do you need to have anybody an admin. So we looked into that technology as a great improvement in managing our environment.
Now, to clarify that a little bit, Andre, when the reality of user account control is not really to say that nobody's an admin, but rather when I log in with administrative credentials, I'm working in a different security model than I have traditionally worked in Microsoft client OSs. Is that a fair statement?
That is, yes. I mean, basically, you, in a simplest deployment, you would roll out Windows Vista in a protected admin mode. And basically, yes, you know, as a user, you would still have admin privileges in that respect. But when you log into your machine, the administrative privileges are split out, so you get into this terminology called a split token, where for your day-to-day processes, you run as a standard user. So you run IE as a standard user, you'd run Office as a standard user, you'd run Notepad as a standard user. But when you needed to run something that required extra access rights to a particular part of, say, the registry or your program files located on your disk, then the system automatically recognizes that and requests that you elevate. So you get a prompt for either consent, which is just a click on OK, or credentials, where you have to type in your credentials. And that basically tells you that you can, you know, elevate up to being a full administrator, and then you have full admin access during that elevated process cycle.
So I log into my machine. my user account has administrative rights, but there is this split token. And as I'm working, doing my daily work, everything looks like it would normally look. But if I go to launch the event viewer, install an application, or do something that would require administrative privileges, I get a user account control prompt, and there's a requirement for user interaction. I've got to say continue, and then I get those elevated permissions so that I can execute those administrative functions.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Now, what's the practical upshot of that? Why do I care about that? Doesn't it just seem like that's a pain that every time I want to do something administrative, I have to click continue?
It can be, but for most users, and let's take, say, an information worker, somebody who doesn't have to do administrative work on their machine or in an enterprise, that all they need to do is use the applications installed on the machine, say Office and maybe a couple of line of business applications, and access some resources like printers. If there's no need for them ever to be elevated to have full admin rights, then there's no requirement for them to do that. So in most instances, we did a lot of work with our LOB teams internally to look at each application and understand how many of them could be changed or modified, and that is obviously an extra piece. Application compatibility comes into this, and making sure that those operate without the need for that elevation. Then for the information workers, they don't necessarily see any difference. They log into the machine, they use the machine, and there's no extra prompt requirements. But for the administrator of a network environment, there's going to be some applications they're going to use that will require them to elevate. And for that, it's a need-to-use basis, if you like. I know I need to use this application, and I need to elevate to use this application. And then when they finish using that application, their system's back now to that standard user mode. And that helps that if an application got installed that was an unwanted application, a piece of spyware or something like that, it doesn't have full access to the whole system. It's only ever going to operate in that standard mode, and it's not going to be able to do the cross-platform into that elevated process. So when you see those dialogues coming up as a user, you understand that something's trying to request admin rights, and was that you that requested that, or is there something, you're browsing the web and you're on a website and for some reason this elevation prompt's come up. Why did it do that? It allows users to sort of question, the requirement of something popping up.
So if I'm out there browsing the web and suddenly a dialogue box pops up that says, "You are about to install Netcat. Are you sure you want to do this?" I can immediately say no and then pull my network cable, right? But I think the point that you're making, what you're getting at, is that those background processes, those malicious processes that would normally happen transparently in the background, they can't function that way, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So I'm aware that something's happening, and I can interrupt it. What's to stop a hacker or someone that's writing malicious code from including in their install script a tab enter so that dialog box just goes away?
The protected desktop, which is kind of plays into the whole UAC prompt. If you ever notice, when you get the UAC prompt or a consent prompt, your screen, I wouldn't say grays out, but darkens. That is the protected desktop. And what that is just like when you hit control delete and you log on initially to stop or pause processes. That is built around the protection of throwing up a dialog box with a consent prompt, if you can map one out using some sort of graphic utility to create a consent prompt. The protected desktop, if it's enabled and turned on, would prevent that.
So as soon as that UAC is invoked, those other executables stop. Is that basically what you're saying?
Pause, yes.
Or pause, pardon me. Are paused so that someone who creates malicious code should not be able to leverage their own scripting to get around that UAC prompt.
Correct, provided that protected desktop is enabled.
Provided that it's protected.
Which it is by default. It definitely is in controllable via group policy.
So I think there's clear advantage to user account control. What other sorts of security features are we leveraging out of Windows Vista, out of the box, within Microsoft?
IE7, which actually goes hand in hand with IE7 with protected mode, goes hand in hand with UAC. Offers a very, very similar type of protection. Once again, focused on least user privilege. So IE itself runs in protected mode, which really protects, I would warrant, would be the most exploited use of code out in the environment, which is you're surfing the network, or the internet, I'm sorry, and you're going to different websites, then, you know, you open a big hole there that can be targeted maliciously by external websites or external code. IE7 has introduced a lot of new features, protected mode being one. So you've got the, starting off, your least user privilege mode. They've introduced cross-site scripting protection, which is in the past for a lot of browsers been an issue, where you actually are thinking you're typing in your bank identification for your Bank of America site, but it's actually sending you to redirecting the keystrokes to another website. Now they actually have, they will make it so the URL or address bar is always displayed in any dialog box, and it really stops against cross-site scripting. URL handling, if someone passed a malformed or excessively linked URL, that could cause code to crash and could cause you to execute some other code that was in the web page. That has been completely changed, so URL handling will not cause code execution if that is actually in the code. And also ActiveX opt-in, which historically, ActiveX controls just ran. If you went to a web page, it would just run. Now, with the opt-in feature, you can actually go to the web page, and you actually have to opt-in, i.e., select that you want to actually run the ActiveX control before it launches. That was like a big change. The big changes are happening with IE7.
So, as a user, if I regularly go to, let's say, the Microsoft website and take downloads that require things like the Genuine Advantage process to run, I'll get a dialog box that says, I need to install this ActiveX control to let this happen.
Exactly.
And I choose to do that.
Yep.
Okay. So if I'm at a website that I don't know what it is or why I need that, I can choose to say no.
Correct.
And let's go back for a second. I want to talk a little bit more about IE7 in protected mode. What's happening there exactly? What is protected mode? And why should I feel protected because I'm running in protected mode?
You can think of protected mode as like a bit like sandboxing. It's an environmental zone where, you know, that particular session runs in. And protected mode is only available in IE7 on Vista. It's not available in the standard IE7 you can download on XP today, so there's a difference there. Protected mode requires UAC, you know, uses the user account control functions, and basically it allows virtualization. So if you go to a website that downloads some malware in the background, it's only going to impact, if it does actually get installed, that user session. But it allows the website to sort of continue through, but everything is sandboxed off. When those sessions are closed down, that area is cleared out, it's all virtualized out. So it's just a different method of operating. Everything runs at a very low privilege. So IE is actually just a low privilege application. In some instances, if an application wants to open up an Excel spreadsheet, for example, Excel runs at a higher privilege. So it opens up a brand new window, and depending on how you've got machine configured up, will just open up Excel for you. So, you know, it changes the way some sites will operate depending on what you're working on.
So to break it down to its simplest form, we can think of IE7 in protected mode as a sandboxed environment. And anything that happens during that session happens within that sandbox. And when I close that session, that stuff goes away. I know that's somewhat oversimplified, but at its most basic level, is that fair?
At its most basic, yeah, that's the fairest way to sort of, you know, look at that. And as I said, with UAC as well, you know, you're restricting again those applications that want to try and gain administrative access to your system to the lowest degree, so you have that extra layer of control in there.
So, gentlemen, my sister called me up last week, and don't get me wrong, I love my sister dearly, but I often wonder if I did the right thing when I wired her house for broadband. And she calls me up and she says, Michael, is it possible that I have money in a PayPal account in China? And, of course, the answer to that is no, right? She's gotten some phishing email. She's gone to this phishing website, and she's being prompted to enter this personal identifying information. What have we done in IE7 to protect my sister from that kind of threat?
Well, some of that comes in the URL handling. Some of it comes in the cross-site scripting protection. When you get to a site where it's malformed in that, you know, part of the address bar starts going to IP numbers, then the address bar will go red. They're starting to use colors and the shield. If, for example, a website is trying to load a certificate that's not valid, you'll get a red X up there on next to the address bar around the certificate.
And so this is all a function of the anti-phishing filter.
It's all of, exactly, all a function of the anti-phishing filter. If you change the configuration of your the security settings within IE7, then when you go back into IE or when you open up a new session, you get prompted to say that your security settings are low and you want to fix them. So there's a quick, easy button to put your settings back to what they should be. So there's a lot more user presentation of what you're trying to go to allow, basically give as much information to the user to say, yes, this is a good site that you can go to, and you can sort of be pretty assured that that's what you can enter your data into.
Or I get those warning colors that warn me that potentially this site is a threat to me.
Yeah,
great.
Exactly.
How does that anti-phishing filter work? I mean, how does it recognize these phishing sites?
It does a lookup. There is a database. Exactly whereabouts it is, I would have to go and verify. But basically, the URLs are verified to see that they are valid. And a lot of websites within i7 today, you'll also see that some of them actually have a small icon where the HTTP page is. You'll see a small icon appear, you know, like the logo of the company or something like that. A lot of that it can be seen as a more of a trusted, you know, we know who the site is. We've verified it against our, you know, external database that shows what all these sites are. So we can sort of guarantee that that is a good site. And that hooks in with, you know, the red address bar that if it's a site we don't recognize and it doesn't go against our list and we don't, you know, recognize what it is, then we change that address bar to be red. But you do have the ability within that phishing filter to also report on those and send feedback on them.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening internally. I know I've been running Windows Vista since September as my client operating system, and I've gone through RC1. I did not do RC2, but I stuck with RC1, and now have upgraded to the RTM version. How many Windows desktops are we currently running internally? Windows Vista desktops are we currently running internally?
So current numbers, I mean, and these are mixed builds. Bear in mind, within Microsoft, we've been using Vista for some time as, you know, we've been developing it, but rolling it out from an IT perspective, we started with the December CTP last December. So from there forward, the builds have been updated, you know, on a weekly/monthly basis. Currently, the numbers are
How many, I'm sorry?
About 50,000 client machines.
About 50,000 client machines.
Yeah.
And what's our goal 30 to 90 days out from RTM?
So the IT goal is for 90,000 systems at the RTM day plus 90 days.
And, Andre, you were involved in the creation of the image that Microsoft IT has made available for users to, you know, download and deploy onto their machine. What was that process like?
It was a good process. I mean, we went through various configurations. We were striving to utilize SMS to do, you know, the OS deployment piece. We used WDS, Windows Deployment Services. We used Windows Deployment Services for distributing down the BitLocker version, which is regarding the encryption and using the Trusted Platform module to encrypt the data on your drive. So we used WDS for that. And then we're using Business Desktop Deployment Services, BDD, to to do a deployment out through SMS and utilize that technology for rolling out the image. Creating the image itself, you know, it is a bigger image. We're looking at creating the image with both with Office 2007 within it, and we're covering the generic basic configuration that our clients use. We don't include all the LOB applications, but we try and include as many of the controls and core applications that people need, basically to reduce the time it takes for them to install. Once they kick off the install, we want users when it's completed to come back to be able to at least start being able to use their machine. They can fire up their email and start working. They can use Word, etc., and start working. You know, their browsers configured up so that when they go to internal sites for LOB applications, those will start working. Whereas in the past, you know, you'd install the OS and then you have to go and install the applications you wanted, and it could take a period of time before you were functional.
Now, you mentioned BitLocker, BitLocker drive encryption. What is that?
So BitLocker drive encryption is another technology within Windows Vista. And basically, the concept of BitLocker is to encrypt your data. So the data at rest on your PC. And before this, we had EFS, the encrypted file system, file services, which basically allow you to encrypt a folder or a file. BitLocker drive encryption allows you to encrypt the whole drive. So in a Windows Vista configuration, as a simplistic configuration would be two partitions, a system partition and then the OS partition. The system partition is about a 1 gig partition where you have the core boot files, it's in the clear, and that allows the system to boot up, and then the OS partition where the OS is installed is what gets encrypted, and the whole drive is encrypted. And if you have a system that uses the TPM chip, the Trusted Platform Module, Windows Vista takes advantage of that chip and allows the encryption to happen, you know, through the processes that are available on that piece of hardware. So it's a hardware mode to allow encryption. And there are various modes for startup to use, startup with a PIN. Today we have it configured up so that the users can decide if they want to have a PIN to start up or use a USB key. But we do escrow the keys, the recovery key, into our Active Directory so that if a client has a machine, and this is one of the great features of BitLocker drive encryption, if their machine breaks, for example, let's say the screen breaks totally, or they drop the machine and they have to take the hard drive out and put it into another system, and they fire it up into another machine that's of the same type, or part of it they took it out of, obviously, then BitLocker is going to kick in and say, something's changed. And they would have to put in their recovery key. And being as we have that escrowed off into AD, it's a simple call to our help desk to request that recovery key so they can recover the data that's on there.
So without that decryption key, without that key, can I start the machine up?
You'd be able to turn the machine on, and it would fire up, and it would get to a point where it's gone through the BIOS checks and say, this machine's got encryption, what is the recovery key? That's it. You would not be able to boot up into the OS.
So I can't help but think, I know we have a customer who loses, on average, one laptop a day in yellow cabs in an unnamed East Coast city.
This is exactly what BitLocker drive encryption is geared for, and that is the unintentional loss or inappropriate, I guess, destruction of retired assets. So BitLocker is one of the methods that was designed to help ensure that the data you have on your drive, which is usually more important than the piece of hardware itself, is safe. I mean, we hear reports all the time of personally identifiable information on some, you know, healthcare provider or insurance company or, you know, ad nauseum government agency.
Veterans Administration.
Exactly. You know, They lose it in an airport, they leave it in a cab, whatever it is, and this is one of the methods that really helps customers ensure that the data will not be able to be mined off the hardware.
Because, you know, today, if I get in a cab and there's a laptop there and I take it home with me, I may not have the guy's username or password, but I can pull that drive out, throw it into a USB enclosure, and walk that file system, right?
Correct, yep.
Yeah.
But with BitLocker drive encryption, that all goes away.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Brilliant, gentlemen. Well, we are just about out of time. Are there any closing comments? Is there anything that you'd like to say, gentlemen, before we close?
I just want to call out the fact that I'm really strongly behind this. I do think it's a major change in terms of how Windows deals with security. It's a much more secure and robust operating system. It just does take some getting used to. That, I would say, is the biggest thing, is that there is change. It is positive change, and it's a more secure change, but it does take some getting used to, especially from an IT perspective and standpoint.
Yeah, I think I would second that. It's, in a way, as you can imagine, the change from like Windows 3.1 to Windows 98 to Windows XP, it's the next life cycle of the Windows operating system, and it's even more secure.
And having been the guy in my office that refused to migrate from WordStar to WordPerfect, I understand the challenges of change and adapting to change. So, gentlemen, I genuinely appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you
for the opportunity.
And ladies and gentlemen, for How Microsoft Does IT, I'm Michael Murphy. Thank you all for joining us today, and we will see you next time on the radio.
Michael Murphy, Andre Howard, and Ben Shai on TechNet Radio. For more information on how Microsoft does IT, you can go ahead and visit the website. It's microsoft.com/technet/itsolutions/msit/default.mspx. And that is a pretty long URL, so I'll put that up on our website, microsoft.com/tnradio. There's a TechNet webcast. It's titled Using Windows Vista Readiness Assessment to Determine the Capabilities of Your Organization's Computer Hardware. That's a level 200 webcast, and it's on Wednesday, December 6th at 8 a.m. Pacific Time. If you're wondering whether the computer hardware and devices you manage are ready for Windows Vista operating system, then check out this webcast. You'll learn how the Windows Vista Readiness Assessment Tool can help you centrally assess the hardware capabilities of your computers and devices from a single networked computer. They'll describe how the Windows Vista Readiness Assessment Tool provides detailed computer-by-computer reporting and upgrade recommendations that can help you prepare for migrating to Windows Vista. To find that event and other webcasts, you can visit microsoft.com/webcasts. On Monday, December 11th through Wednesday, December 13th in Boston, Web Design World takes place. Web Design World brings together beauty and brains in three compelling days. Dive into breakout sessions and workshops that discuss the best tips and tricks for strategic design and user-friendly pages while embracing the most sophisticated web technology available. For more information on that event, visit ftponline.com/conferences/webdesignworld. We always love to get your feedback, so if you have any, you can go ahead and shoot me an email at tnradio@microsoft.com. Or you can give a call, 877-814-6506. Thanks for listening today. I look forward to next time. For everyone here at TechNet Radio, I'm Aurora Queen.
Have comments or want to request a story idea? Call us at 1-877-814-6506.